Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Unbelievably, right, if you know a little bit about the history of our country, this song, so emblematic of protesting during the 60s and even the 70s, what is it about? It's about a protest about a curfew on the Sunset Strip. I think that's awesome. And it's worth, that's why life is worth digging into, right? Well, what spawned the song, right? Who were these guys? Well, they're high school dropouts. Some pretty famous ones, too. Now, what are they doing? They're playing music in Los Angeles. And their world's getting wrecked by this curfew and shit. And the cops were telling people they got to go home at 10 o'clock. People were saying, we're not going. Yeah, shit's getting out of control, man. So anyway, normally the sign is emblematic that something's disturbing me. And something is disturbing me. And I think if you listen to the program, one of the primary themes is of what disturbs me is the state of the nation today. And chief among those are institutions, you know, that are supposed to be leaders and be leaders in our country? Thought leaders, maybe? Yeah, that's a term that's popular now. Yeah, thought leaders in our country. And they have shit-canned that role because they believe that they are now supposed to be activists. And so in the shit-canning of that role and the turning their back on their function in a democracy, they've made the democracy weaker. And their intention is to make the democracy more in their liking, okay? Which, right, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so, I mean, to me, the chief example in the country is the New York Times. You know, the New York Times evidently filled with young people, idealistic, right, who've been raised in the world of journalism today, and that world is a world not where they should simply be reporters and let the reader decide. As a phrase I heard that I think is very good says, we are the first writers. We write the first draft of history. And as such, we should be faithful to it. Whoa, yeah, exactly. That's pretty deep this early in the morning, Mac. What the hell? So, I'm stapling two things. Don't hate me. Over the weekend, there was a column written by an op-ed guy in the New York Times about the failure of the Times pet project, and that is the 1619 Project. Now, to me, what's problematic about the project is this, right? It's been absolutely excoriated, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, by academics, not by conservatives from, you know, Fox News, although they've piled on. But academics have said this stuff is factually wrong. This stuff is factually wrong. And in fact, what, last week or the week before, you had academics from an assortment of hugely prominent universities saying that the Pulitzer Prize need to be rescinded for the work that was done. Now, only the naive say, well, it can't get any worse. Oh, au contraire, mon frère. It can get worse. And so I want to read you a couple things. One, I spoke about this before, and I didn't read it. I didn't personally read it, let alone bring it on the air. So therefore, I didn't bring it on the air. Had I read it, the whole thing, I certainly would have. So over the weekend, one of the writers, a guy named Brett Stevens, an op-ed guy, so he's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, Brett Stevens, he writes a piece where he talks about the merits of the 1619 projects and some of the good things that have happened because of it, and then he talks about, but it is a failure. And so I want to read you something that a guy in the Intercept wrote, a guy named Glenn Greenwald. But the chain of events is Stevens writes this column. The New York Times Guild, so this is the union of the employees of the newspaper, tweets that he should be fired and blah, 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 blah. The union of writers and in the tweet, there's like the grammar is poor, the punctuation is wrong. So it's like this from the guild, the union of the leading newspaper, the paper of record in the United States, as it's called. All right. So, I want to read you parts of this, right? So this is from Glenn Greenwald. The New York Times Guild, the union of employees of the paper of record, tweeted a condemnation on Sunday of one of their own colleagues, op-ed columnist Brett Stevens. Their denunciation was marred by humiliating typos and even more so by creepy and authoritarian censorship demands and petulant appeals to management to enforce company, quote, rules, unquote, against other journalists. To say that this is bizarre behavior from a union of journalists, of all people, is to woefully understate the case. What angered the union today was an op-ed by Stevens on Friday, which voiced numerous criticisms of the Pulitzer Prize-winning 1619 Project, published last year by the New York Times and spearheaded by reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones. One of the project's principal arguments was expressed by a now silently deleted sentence that introduced it. Quote, that the country's true birth date is not 1776, as has long been widely believed, but rather 1619, when, the article claims, the first African slaves arrived on U.S. soil. The despite its Pulitzer, the 1619 Project has become a hotly contested political and academic controversy, with the Trump administration seeking to block attempts to integrate its assertions into school curriculums, while numerous scholars of history accuse it of radically distorting historical facts, with some, such as Brown University's Glenn Lowry, calling for the Pulitzer Prize Board to revoke the award. Scholars have also vocally criticized the Times for stealth edits of the article's key claims long after publication, without even noting to readers that it was made, that it, the change was made, let alone explaining why it made them. So, I mean, think about that. That's from the nation's leading newspaper. All right. But again, it gets worse. In STEM, the still-raging political, historical, and journalistic debate over the 1619 Project has become a major controversy. In his Friday column, Stevens addressed the controversy by first noting the project's positive contributions and accomplishments, then reviewed in detail the critiques of historians and other scholars of its central claims, and then sided with its critics by arguing for all its virtues, buzz, spin-offs, and a Pulitzer Prize, the 1619 Project has failed. Without weighing in on the merits of Stevens' critiques, some of which I agree with and some of which I do not, it is hardly debatable that his discussing this vibrant multi-pronged debate is squarely within his function as a political op-ed writer at a national newspaper. Stevens himself explained that he took the unusual step of critiquing his own employer's work because the 1619 Project has become, partly by its design, partly because of the avoidable mistakes, a focal point of the kind of intense national debate that columnists are supposed to cover. Contending that avoiding the writing about it out of collegial deference is to be derelict in our responsibilities to participate in society's significant disputes. Now, I mean, that's just like, duh, right? So this is a controversy, and I'm not supposed to write about it. I'm not supposed to speak my mind about it. I mean, that's quintessentially an American, right? Let alone to be a writer in the quote-unquote paper of record in the country. He goes on. But his colleagues at the New York Times Guild evidently do not believe that he has any right to express his views on these debates. Indeed, they are indignant that he did so. In a barely literate tweet that not once but twice misspelled the word its, right? Right? So it was you being used in the possessive, right? And in the tweet, it's used as a contraction, as in it is, right? So some people might just go, blah, right? But if you're a journalist, that's like, that's not acceptable. And he goes on, not a trivial level ignorance for writers with the world's most influential paper. The union denounced Stevens and the paper itself on these grounds. And here's the tweet, verbatim. It says a lot about an organization when it breaks its own rules and goes after one of its own. The act, comma, like the article, reeks. So that's the tweet. It is a short tweet, as tweets go, but they impressively managed to pack it with multiple ironies, fallacies, and decrees typical of the petty tyrant. Above all else, the statement and the mentality it reflects is profoundly unjournalistic. To start with, this is a case of journalists using their union not to demand greater editorial freedom for journalistic independence, something one would reasonably expect from a journalist union, but demanding it the opposite, that writers at the New York Times be prohibited by management from expressing their views and perspectives about the controversies surrounding the 1619 Project. In other words, they're demanding that their own journalistic colleagues be silenced and censored. What kind of journalist pleads with management for greater restrictions on journalistic expression rather than fewer? Apparently, the answer is the New York Times journalist. Indeed, this is not the first time they have publicly implored corporate management to restrict the freedom of expression and editorial freedom of their journalistic colleagues. At the end of July, the Guild issued a series of demands, one of which was that, quote, sensitivity reads, I'd never heard that term, by the way, quote, sensitivity reads should happen at the beginning of the publication process with compensation for those who do them. For those not familiar with the term sensitivity reads, consider yourself fortunate. As the New York Times itself reported in 2017, sensitivity readers have been used by book publishers to gut books that have been criticized in order to, quote, vet the narrative for harmful stereotypes and suggested changes. So it's censorship. We don't like how you're saying this, and we won't publish it until you make these changes. It's what the Chinese do. Yeah, you won't, that movie, Top Gun, won't fly with the patch of Taiwan on it and whatever the second patch, the patch of Japan on it. They need to go. The Guardian explained in 2018 that sensitivity readers, oh, and let me go back to China. And there was a time and date when that scene would have been shot twice. One for the Chinese market. And then the second one, not using the jacket, for everybody else. Now the Chinese say, no, 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 you won't make that version at all. So you wonder how this shit all ends, right? The Guardian explained in 2018, Guardian's another newspaper out of the UK, that, quote, sensitivity readers, unquote, are a rapidly growing industry in the book publishing world to weed out any implicit bias or potentially objectionable material. Not just in storylines, but even in characters. It quoted the author Lionel Shriver about the obvious dangers. There is, she said. Yeah, Lionel's a girl, evidently. There is, she said, quote, a thin line between combing through manuscripts for anything potentially objectionable to particular subgroups and overt political censorship. I don't think there's a thin line there. I think there's no line. I think it's the same thing. You just put lipstick on that pig. As creepy as sensitivity readers are for fiction writing and other publishing fields, it is indescribably toxic for journalism, which necessarily questions or pokes at, rather than bows to, the most cherished sacred pieties. For it to be worthwhile, it must publish material, reporting, and opinion pieces that might be potentially objectionable to all sorts of powerful factions, including culturally hegemonic liberals. But this is a function that the New York Times Union wants not merely to avoid fulfilling themselves, but far worse, to deny their fellow journalists. They crave a whole new layer of editorial hoop jumping in order to get published, a cumbersome, repressive new protocol for drawing even more constraining lines around what can and cannot be said. When journalists exploit their unions, not to demand better pay, improve benefits, enhance job security, or greater journalistic independence, but instead as an instrument of censorship for their own journalistic colleagues, then the concept of unions and journalism is widely perverted. Now, he goes on, I won't bother you with, with all the article. So let me read a couple more parts of it, and because this led me to a second piece that I want to read for you. The hypocrisy of the union's grievance is almost too glaring to even bother highlighting, and is the least of its sins. The union members denounced Stevens and the paper for, quote, going after one of their own, and then, in the next breath, publicly vilify their colleague's column in their erudite view, comma, it reeks. This is the same union whose members just a few months ago quite flamboyantly staged a multi-day social media protest, a quite public one, in a fit of rage because the paper's opinion editor, James Bennett, published an op-ed piece by U.S. Senator Tom Cotton advocating the deployment of U.S. military to repress riots and protests in U.S. cities. Bennett lost his job in the fallout, and many of these same union members now posturing as solemn, righteous opponents of publicly going after one's colleagues. Notoriously mocked, scorned, and ridiculed and condemned, first privately and then publicly, another colleague, Barry Weiss, until she left the paper citing these incessant attacks. Clearly, this is not a union that dislikes public condemnations of colleagues. Whatever principle is motivating them, that is plainly not it. I've long been a harsh critic of Stevens and Weiss's journalism and opinion writing, but it would never occur to me to take steps to try to silence them. If they were my colleagues and published an article I disliked or expressed views I found pernicious, I certainly would not whine to management that they broke the rules and insist that they should not be allowed to have expressed what they believed. That's because I'm a journalist, and I know that journalism can have value only if it fosters divergent views and seeks to expand rather than reduce the freedom of discourse and expression permitted by society and by employers. Now, mind you, this is going on at the New York Times. This is going on at the New York Times. He ends like this. Perhaps these tawdry episodes should be unsurprising. After all, one major reason that social media companies, which never wanted the obligation to censor, but instead sought to be content-neutral platforms for the transmission of communications in the mold of AT&T, and that's the controversy they're being hauled up on Capitol Hill for, they say, look, we're a platform provider. We're not a content policer. But on a daily basis, the calls get greater for them to police what's on their platforms, right? Those social media companies turned into active speech regulators was because the public, often led by journalists, began demanding that they censor more. Some journalists even devote significant chunks of their career to publicly complaining that Facebook and Twitter are failing to enforce their rules by not censoring robustly enough. Then he includes one last piece. The New York Times Guild, the union that published that tweet, moments ago deleted its tweet denouncing Stevens and the paper and then posted this. We deleted our previous tweet. It was tweeted in error. We apologize for the mistake. Though the Guild did not specify what error caused them to issue this denunciation, the paper's media reporter, Ben Smith, said, quote, someone else active in the Times Union tells me that a leader of the chapter who runs the account tweeted about Stevens' column without any internal discussion, causing a furor in Slack. I don't know what Slack is. It's a reference to, I don't know, a building where the New York Times is located. I'm not sure what it refers to, but it's referencing the New York Times. And drawing heated objections from others in the Guild, leading to this deletion and apology. Now I say it to you because let me walk you down a hypothetical. So you now have the paper of record in the United States, the New York Times, who's more interested in its role, not as a journalistic tool, but its role as an activist organization that uses its media to influence rather to inform. And then the response will be, well, they believe they have to do that because of Donald Trump. So Joe Biden gets elected. Does anybody believe that they will perform an about-face and recede back into their historical role in the nation in this open forum when things are not as when things are not as hostile as they are with Donald Trump at the helm of the United States. Anybody believe that? I mean, I don't. So, I mean, to me, these are the kind of things that to me are extremely disturbing, because there's certain things in our democracy that are important. And the exchange of free ideas, the articulate exchange of free ideas, is really important. And the only way something like the 1619 Project can go where it's gone, given the historical lies that it tells, given its condemnation not by politicians, but by historians, is that if somebody's got an agenda, somebody's got a platform, and somebody's willing to protect it and just say, we will broker no dissent. Well, what is that? I mean, dare I say that's a form of totalitarianism? And when you can't count on the nation's paper record to tell you the truth, to be welcome to all ideas, then where are you? What have you done? And how has that organization lost its way so deeply? Now, Barry Weiss, I'm no stranger to, right? So, I want to read you what Barry Weiss wrote in her resignation letter, in her letter to the editor and publisher. I think, I'm not sure that they're the same thing. I'm using phraseology, but I believe he's the publisher, Mr. A.G. Sulzberger. Because, and again, I want you to listen. So this is the kind of fight that's going on in the media today that brings you. And then again, is there any expectation that this is going to change back to a more open, balanced type of reporting? And this is her letter to him when she resigned this summer. Dear AG, it is with sadness I write to tell you that I'm resigning from the New York Times. I joined the paper with gratitude and optimism 3 years ago. I was hired with the goal of bringing in voices that would not otherwise appear in your pages. First-time writers, centrists, conservatives, and others who would not naturally think the Times as their home. The reason for this effort was clear. The paper's failure to anticipate the outcome of the 2016 election meant that it didn't have a firm grasp of the country it covers. Dean Baquet and others, I think he's the editor of the Times, and others have admitted as much on various occasions. The priority in opinion, the section she works in, right? So there's news and opinion, right? They used to be classifieds till the internet came along, right? So the priority in opinion was to help redress that critical shortcoming. I was honored to be part of an effort led by James Bennett, who was fired, right, after the Tom Cotton op-ed. I am proud of my work as a writer and an editor. Among those I help bring to our pages, the Venezuelan dissident Wiley Ortega, the Iranian chess champion Dorsa, I can't pronounce the last name, the Hong Kong Christian Democrat Derek Lam, and then she lists a whole bevy of other people. But the lessons that ought to have followed the election lessons about the importance of understanding other Americans, the necessity of resisting tribalism, and the centrality of free exchange of ideas to a democratic society has not been learned. Think about that. Think about that. This is a writer for the New York Times saying that that organization has not embraced the centrality of the free exchange of ideas in a democratic society. That's stunning. Stunning. Instead, a new consensus has emerged in the press, but perhaps especially at this paper, that truth isn't a process of collective discovery, but an orthodoxy already known to an enlightened few whose job it is to inform everybody else. That's totalitarianism. Twitter is not on the masthead of the New York Times, but Twitter has become its ultimate editor. As the ethics and mores of that platform have become those of the paper itself has increasingly become a kind of performance space. Stories are chosen and told in a way to satisfy the narrowest of audiences, rather than to allow a curious public to read about the world and then draw its own conclusions. I was always taught that journalists were charged with writing the first rough draft of history. Now history itself is one more thing molded to fit the needs of a predetermined narrative. I read this yesterday and I was like, well, how did I miss this past summer? My own forays into wrongthink have made me the subject of constant bullying by colleagues who disagree with my views. They have called me a Nazi and a racist. I have learned to brush off comments about how I'm writing again about the Jews. Several colleagues perceived to be friendly with me were badgered by coworkers. My work and my character are openly demeaned on company-wide Slack channels. Slack must be a slang phrase for the New York Times, where masthead editors regularly weigh in. There, some coworkers insist I need to be rooted out if this company is to be truly an inclusive one. How about the irony of that? In order for us to be more inclusive, we have to eliminate people. What the hell? While others post axe emoji, axe is in like axe, like chopping wood axe, next to my name. Still other New York Times employees publicly smear me as a liar and a bigot on Twitter, with no fear that harassing me will be met with appropriate action. They never are. There are terms for all of this: unlawful discrimination, hostile work environment, and constructive discharge. I'm no legal expert, but I know that this is wrong. I do not understand how you have allowed this kind of behavior to go on inside your company in full view of the paper's entire staff and the public. And I certainly can't square how you and other Times leaders have stood by while simultaneously praising me in private for my courage. Showing up for work as a centrist at an American newspaper should not require bravery. Part of me wishes I could say that my experience was unique, but the truth is that intellectual curiosity, let alone risk-taking, is now a liability at the Times. Why edit something challenging to our readers or write something boldly only to go through the numbing process of making it ideologically kosher when we can assure ourselves of job security, and then in parentheses, and clicks, by publishing our 4,000th op-ed arguing that Donald Trump is a unique danger to the country and the world? And so self-censorship has become the norm. What rules that remain at the Times are applied with extreme selectivity. If a person's ideology is in keeping with a new orthodoxy, they and their work remain unscrutinized. Everyone else lives in fear of the digital thunderdome. Online venom is excused so long as it is directed at the proper targets. Op-eds that would have easily been published just 2 years ago would now get an editor or a writer in serious trouble if not fired. If a piece is perceived as likely to inspire backlash internally or on social media, the editor or the writer avoids pitching it. If she feels strongly enough to suggest it, she is quickly steered to safer ground. And if every now and then she succeeds in getting a piece published that does not explicitly promote progressive causes, it happens only after every line is carefully massaged, negotiated, and caveated. It took the paper 2 days and two jobs to say that the Tom Cotton op-ed, quote, fell short of our standards, unquote. We attached an editor's note on a travel story about Joffre shortly after it was published because it, quote, failed to touch on important aspects of Joffre's makeup and its history. I'm sorry, Joffre's makeup and history. But there is still none appended to Cheryl Strayer's fawning interview with the writer Alice Walker, a proud anti-Semite who believes in lizard Illuminati. So her point. The paper of record is, more and more, the record of those living in a distant galaxy, one whose concerns are profoundly removed from the lives of most people. This is a galaxy in which, to choose just a few recent examples, the Soviet space program is lauded for its diversity, the doxing of teenagers in the name of justice is condoned, and the worst caste system in human history includes the United States alongside Nazi Germany. Even now, I am confident that most people at the Times do not hold these views, yet they are cowed by those who do. Why? Perhaps because they believe the ultimate goal is righteousness? Perhaps because they believe that they will be granted protection if they nod along as the coin of the realm? Language is degraded in service to an ever-shifting laundry list of right causes. Perhaps because there are millions of unemployed people in the country and they feel lucky to have a job in a contracting industry. Or perhaps it's because they know that nowadays standing up for principle at the paper does not win plaudits. It puts a target on your back. Too wise to post on Slack, they write to me privately about the new McCarthyism that has taken root at the paper of record. I mean, so I'm reading this yesterday outside, and I'm thinking, this is like amazing. Barry Weiss is not a conservative. Just so you know. And run out of a job at the New York Times. And what's most interesting is what she was hired for. Right? You remember after the last election, right? How did none of these papers see any of this coming? And the answer, they're so out of touch. They exist in their own echo chamber. And now what they sought to do, in spite of their initial overture to hire people like Barry Weiss to make their op-ed pieces more diverse, the reaction has been, right, to reinforce the echo chamber, run people like Barry Weiss out. But the things that have been allowed to happen that she talks about, I mean, are amazing that would be allowed in a workplace in the name of this. So in the name of social justice, We're gonna violate her in the workplace. We're going to, you know, harass her in public professionally. I mean, who the hell would allow that? And the answer is the New York Times. All of this bodes ill, especially for independent-minded young readers, writers, and editors paying close attention to what they'll have to do to advance in their careers. Rule one, speak your mind at your own peril. Rule two, never risk commissioning a story that goes against the narrative. Rule three, never believe an editor or publisher who urges you to go against the grain. Eventually, the publisher will cave to the mob, the editor will get fired or reassigned, and they'll hang you out to dry. Now, that's her experience, right? So in private, the publisher, you know, lauding her courage, blah, 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 blah. In public, not so much. Her editor gets fired, and then she resigns. For these young writers and editors, there is one consolation. As places like the Times and other once great journalistic institutions betray their standards and lose sight of their principles, Americans will hunger for news that is accurate, opinions that are vital, and debate that is sincere. Amen, sister. Right? I hear from these people every day, An independent press is not a liberal ideal or a progressive ideal or a democratic ideal. It's an American ideal. You said that a few years ago. I couldn't agree more. America is a great country that deserves a great newspaper. She ends like this. None of this means that some of the most talented journalists in the world don't still labor for this newspaper. They do. Which is what makes the illiberal environment especially heartbreaking. I will be, as ever, a dedicated reader of their work, but I can no longer do the work that you brought me here to do, the work that Adolf Ochs, O-C-H-S, described in that famous 1896 statement, quote, to make the columns of the New York Times a forum for the consideration of all questions of public importance, and to that end to invite intelligent discussion from all shades of opinion. Ochs' idea is one of the best I've ever encountered. And I've always comforted myself with the notion that the best ideas win out. But ideas cannot win on their own. They need a voice. They need a hearing. Above all, they must be backed by people willing to live by them. Sincerely, Bari. Now, that's the New York Times. And that's what's happened in our country. And honestly, it's a bit scary. And I see people that are in over their heads, and Mr. Sulzberger is certainly in over his head. He doesn't have the character. He doesn't have the strength to make the New York Times what it used to be in this country, which is, you know, this paper of prominence. I don't read the New York Times for anything. Other than on the odd chance I see Michael Gordon there, and I don't even think he writes there anymore. I don't read what they put out, because it's too far out. You know, when you see that a United States senator can't publish an op-ed, but Nicolai Maduro can, that Vladimir Putin can, it's laughable. It's laughable. And so does that change with the election of Joe Biden? The answer is no, it's not going to change. And so I hope that, as I say, I was encouraged late last week because I see more and more people writing about this. And that is that the day of the, how do I say it? The day that allows the 1619 and all of its historical lies to be published by a prominent journalistic entity, hopefully, are slipping, and that honest, rigorous intellectual discourse is maybe something that more and more people are going to raise the red flag about. But I mean, honestly, when you read that, that's stunning. That sounds like something that would happen at a high school newspaper, right, who had some idealistic young dope, either conservative or liberal, running it, and was running people off and wouldn't let them write what they wanted to write. That's what that sounds like. Sophomoric, stupid bullshit. But what you have is you have one of the major newspapers, media companies in the country, whose content is taken in by millions of people on a daily basis, whose content is retweeted by millions of others on a daily basis. And you have liberals inside the organization using terms like McCarthyism, the new McCarthyism, and even objecting to it. And so to me, I mean, you can see if that's where the media goes, who shames our politicians to behave better? Certainly not the media, because they're in with them now. It's one movement. It's the resistance, and then whatever is opposite of the resistance. I don't even know what you call that. Okay. So when the resistance is no longer the resistance, what is it? Will they change the way they entertain ideas? And to me the answer is no. No, because really it's our totalitarian vision that doesn't include this. I have one other thought. When is the shit in Portland going to stop? I don't rightly understand that. How has that been allowed to go on for so long without people being thrown in jail, without people? I mean, you figure slowly but surely over the course of however, it's over 100 days, right? Over 100 days, slowly but surely, those people are arrested. They continue to do so. They go to jail. Right? Maybe others come out. As long as if they want to peacefully protest, that's fine. But I mean, you see the scenes of the carnage in Portland. How does that continue to go on? I don't rightly get it. So I would tell you that not since the 60s have I seen, the democracy in such a state. Not since the 60s. So anyway, I thought I would share that with you. It's called On the Intercept. The headline is "The New York Times Guild Once Again Demands Censorship of Colleagues." So that got my attention. And then I've spoken about Barry Weiss because I saw something that was written about her, but I didn't actually go and read her letter to the publisher. Wow, I mean that's stunning. To read that. So, the United States Marine Corps band makes this morning official Tuesday. Grant Newsham's going to join us in about 17 minutes. So, good morning to you. Dedicated to the New York Times. I mean, I hope in some way, I don't know what it takes for you to miss the last election, for you to, which essentially you have a nation that is divided almost down the center. That's how close our elections are. And you exclude half those readers from what you write, the way you report. So this is dedicated that in some way, shape, or form, that the people that are there now leave, that other people that have a higher calling, that their news eliminates the filters, and their opinion pages become broader and more inclusive, not less inclusive. So here's to the idea that totalitarianism to McCarthyism that's being practiced at the New York Times ends someday soon.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You gotta win.
Alright, we'll do the weather. We'll check some news headlines. And then Grant will join us. We'll talk the whole bunch of things Chinese. Yeah. Currently in Quantico, it is mostly cloudy in 63. Down the coast of Camp Lejeune, cloudy in 72. 29 Palms, sun in 75. Pendleton, sun in 72. Camp Smith in Hawaii, dark, cloudy in 74. Okinawa, clear, dark in 73. And in the southern hemisphere, we go in Darwin, clear, dark in 82. And in Oslo, I just found out my kid deployed yesterday. Yeah. I saw a picture of him on Instagram walking with my grandson with a whole bunch of luggage. So I called my daughter-in-law. I said, hey, by the by, did Nut-Nut deploy? Oh, yeah. I'm like, you think? You think maybe an email or a text? Yo, bro, I'm out for a couple months. Unbelievable. So in Norway, where my son might be, it is sunny and 47 degrees. So good luck to him there. Put your sweater on. At the home of All Marine Radio, the Costa Mesa Newport Beach area of Southern California, it is sunny and 68 degrees. Looking for a high today, all the way up to 85. 82 tomorrow, 85 on Thursday, 86 on Saturday, 86 on Friday, 81 on Saturday. So, yeah, got warm out here. All right. Now, we'll check some headlines. I failed to do that yesterday because, I don't know, I got carried away. If you want to read what we're going to talk about on Thursday, they're posted on, if you go to the post-traumatic winning tab on All Marine Radio, or post-traumatic winning, it's there too. You go to post-traumatic winning tab, all the way to the bottom it says resources. Click on that. And at the bottom of that page, you'll see Stockdale on Stoicism 1, the Stoic Warrior's Triad, and then, which actually, interestingly enough, is a speech given at Amphibious Warfare School. I wonder if that's on video. I'd love to maybe play it. And then the second paper is Master My Fate, Stockdale on Stoicism 2. So we'll talk about Stoicism and Epictetus and its influence on Stockdale. So if you want to follow along the discussion, that's where you will find some of the stuff that we will discuss. Anyway, top headlines. The coronavirus count in Stars and Stripes continues to be the daily fare. U.S. strikes Taliban in Afghanistan's Helmand province. So, again, supposedly we're doing peace talks in Afghanistan. And not exactly sure why, but the Taliban have... Is this the boot on your throat? Now that we have you at the table, know this, that we're about to make this shit worse, so you better cut a deal. Is that what that is? American forces launched airstrikes in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province after Afghan forces there came under attack from the Taliban. The 2 days of strikes were in line with the peace agreement signed by the Americans and the Taliban in February, according to Colonel Sonny Leggett. And then there's a map. Despite the escalating violence, the U.S. is on a course to fulfill its key commitment made under the deal with the Taliban to withdraw all foreign forces by May of next year. So again, I don't know. I mean, again, what was the phrase we used? Not cautiously pessimistic, but something else. This is kind of an interesting thing. USS Nimitz crew welcomed a COVID-free bubble during Bahrain visit. So you go out to deploy, where can you go? Only to places with U.S., you know, bases, and you get off and you can stay on base. The Nimitz became the first U.S. carrier to put the Navy's coronavirus-related port call procedures to the test in Bahrain when it pulled into port last week. With the guided missile cruiser USS Princeton, the Nimitz arrived in Manama for a scheduled visit, which began last Wednesday and ended on Sunday. During the stay, a working port call for logistics and maintenance, the ship's sailors and Marines got to rest and unwind in designated areas on the pier that complied with U.S. and host nation measures to stem the spread of the coronavirus. Ugh. The Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Program set up food, drinks, and various games in cordoned-off areas to allow the crew to be in the COVID-free bubble. The procedures have been developed and refined during several smaller ship port calls, which were coronavirus-free. The crews were also able to use the Navy Exchange. Oh, my God. Were they allowed to drink? Oh. We had to do that in Japan once, and it was awful. It was like, you know, it's like you're usually on ship. Now you're with the same people. Now you're off the ship. It's kind of the same, but at least you're off the ship. It was the best they could do. After we got confined to the ship because there was too much drinking and stupidity going on in Sasebo, Japan. Sasebo, Japan, not exactly made for a port call for United States naval warships. From the Wall Street Journal, top headlines, Amy Coney Barrett, that's her name, faces questions from lawmakers. Healthcare abortion rights take spotlight on a second day of hearings. Let me just tell you, all this is the theatrics of the Senate confirmation process. There's nothing to do with anything. And she has to sit there and endure this shit while they make their political points. Next headline on Wall Street, regulation. Joe Biden keeps everyone guessing. Joe Biden trying to waltz into the presidency. How many weeks away? 3 weeks away? Waltz into the presidency and never really tip his cards on what the hell. On what the hell he would do with the country. So happy birthday to the United States Navy. Let's see. SecNav's message to the Navy. Let's see if it has operational excellence anywhere in it.
To our sailors, civilians, and proud Navy families, happy 245th birthday.
Now, this is the Secretary of the Navy, former public affairs officers.
Through your service and excellence, each of you forges the next link in our chain. Extending from the days of our Navy's birth during the American Revolution to many challenges we face around the world today. 75 years ago, our Navy achieved a great and unprecedented victory at sea in the Pacific. The conflict that began right here at Pearl Harbor was secured in victory through the determination and skill of every sailor who stepped forward to defend our nation in its hour of need. It took all hands to achieve such a hard-fought victory that was never fully assured. Those who went before us took to the sea, the skies, and the depths of the oceans in order to preserve our nation for us and succeeding generations. They served through adversity, far from home, with some never returning. Their lasting memorial is the world they created, the world that you now stand to protect in your service to our nation. I am honored to stand with you in that mission. Thank you for all that you and your families do for our Navy and our country. And on behalf of the American people, Bravo Zulu to each of you. Happy birthday, Navy.
There you have it. Happy birthday, Navy. Go Navy, man. So happy birthday to all you sailors out
Shipmates.
There. Oh, that was the CNO's message. I clipped it, sorry. Let me cover a few more stories, then we'll get Grant on. Chinese increasing nuclear submarine shipyard capacity. I wonder why. panel, the pace of Navy freedom of navigation operations is stressing the force. Okay, somehow or other we can't do that in the construct of our operations. We're talking about freedom of navigation acts. We're talking about driving a ship someplace. You got to be kidding me. Is that too hard now? Ugh, my God. State Department official. U.S. ties with Japan, India, and Australia should be a model for the region. Now, that's an interesting story, but I don't have time for it. Let me give you a couple headlines from Marine Corps Times. Marine Corps Assistant Commandant tests positive for COVID-19. Everybody knew that, right? Can a military prosecute decades-old rape cases? The Supreme Court will soon decide that. Marine Corps creates a new MOS for MQ-9 Reaper pilots. Yeah. Two men who were arrested in the plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan were Marine veterans. Marine veterans. Who were they? When did they serve? Joe Morrison was a Marine reservist who joined the Marine Corps in March of 2015, was discharged from the reserves as a Lance Corporal on Thursday, Captain Joseph Butterfield said. Joined in 2015. He was assigned to Engineer Support Company, 4th Marine Logistics Group, Battle Creek, Michigan. His exit from the reserve had nothing to do with the alleged kidnapping plot. Daniel Harris was an 0311 who joined the Marine Corps in 2015, was discharged in June of 2019 after serving in 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, based out of Camp Lejeune, Butterfield said. So two Lance Corporals gone wrong. There you have it. The and I will say this. And I'll link it back to the New York Times piece, and then I'll do the top five in Early Bird. When you have institutions that no longer are about the truth and people become disillusioned, that's when stuff like this happens. And so to me, the impact they're attempting to have creates an absolute backlash of the opposite. Because nobody feels like, look, nobody's listening anymore. I mean, now they won't even print stuff. The New York Times won't even listen to this stuff. So I think it just adds to the frustration that many people feel. Top five stories in Early Bird. Number one, U.S. forces hit Taliban with an airstrike in Helmand. Number two, top general dodges Afghanistan plans. General Mark Milley would not discuss specific plans, but insisted the United States would responsibly end the war. Number three, U.S. advances three arms sales packages to Taiwan. Here. Chinese increasing nuclear submarine shipyard capacity. And number five, what could Turkey's latest S-400 missile test mean? Good question. All right, we'll take a break. Grant Newsham joins us next here on a Tuesday. Whatever you do, don't touch that dial. Grant's always an interesting guy.
We used to get together every week. She's been home from her last deployment for months now, and I haven't seen her once.
He's just been different since he got back from Iraq. One minute he's ready to go, and the next he doesn't want anyone around.
The nightmares are back and seem to be getting worse. Shouldn't he be sleeping better after all these years?
A lot of people don't understand what veterans go through during their service or when they come back, and that's okay.
But everyone can help.
You can make a difference in the life of a veteran.
You stood by us when we were in uniform, so stand by us now.
Like my brother did, when he wouldn't take no for an answer.
Like my wife did, when she asked the right questions.
Like my friend did, when she made the call.
Take a stand for those who served our country.
If you're a veteran in crisis, or know one who is, the Confidential Veterans Crisis Line is here for you. Call 1-800-273-8255.